Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and welcome to Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow, April 4th, 2008, marks the 40th anniversary of the day the Reverend Martin Luther King was shot and killed. Today, King is honored with a national holiday celebrating his birthday, but we often forget that during his life he was hated and reviled, not just by a few individuals, but by millions who were threatened by his marches, by his push for change, and by his sermons, which at times contained a forceful and unambiguous condemnation of his own country and what he termed as its immoral, unchristian actions during a time of segregation and later during a time of war.
Another lie and another love are hanging on, we push and shove. Possession is the motivation that is hanging up the goddamn nation. Looks like we always end up in a rut. Everybody now trying to make it real compared to what? Come on, baby.
Today, 40 years later, another black minister is under attack for words that again seem harsh, unforgiving, and unpatriotic to millions of Americans. Jeremiah Wright of Trinity United Church of Christ preaches to a congregation in the midst of poverty and violence on the south side of Chicago. His words have been condemned, and brief incendiary passages have been repeated over and over in the media, casting doubts on the presidential ambitions of one of the church's most famous members, Barack Obama.
Folks don't know just what it's for. Nobody gives us a rhyme or reason. Have one doubt, they call it treason. We're chicken feathers all the way out one nut. God damn it, trying to make it real compared to what? Suck it to me.
Today on Route 51, we look at the ministry of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright as we examine questions of church and state, religion and race, the media and politics, and poverty in America. With our guests, the Reverend Paul Beckel of the First Universalist Unitarian Church of Wausau, who has attended services at Trinity United Church and has studied the work of its controversial minister. Also on our panel today, Daryl Mayfield. He's a self-employed businessman who teaches courses on cultural diversity at Upper Iowa University. You may have seen him speak at the Martin Luther King celebrations that have taken place in the greater Wausau area over the past couple of years. As always, we invite you to join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or if you're calling from the Wausau area, 261-6371. That's 261-6371. Paul and Daryl, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And before we start, I want to play a clip from a speech by Barack Obama that was widely received, well received, on race and religion, a speech that he had to give in the wake of the controversial comments of his former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Here are his comments and his reflections on Trinity United Church on the south side of Chicago.
Like other predominantly black churches across the country, Trinity embodies the black community in its entirety, the doctor and the welfare mom, the model student and the former gangbanger. Like other black churches, Trinity's services are full of raucous laughter and sometimes bawdy humor. They are full of dancing and clapping and screaming and shouting that may seem jarring to the untrained ear. The church contains in full the kindness and cruelty, the fierce intelligence and the shocking ignorance, the struggles and successes, the love and, yes, the bitterness and biases that make up the black experience in America. And this helps explain, perhaps, my relationship with Reverend Wright. As imperfect as he may be, he has been like family to me. He strengthened my faith, officiated my wedding, and baptized my children. Not once in my conversations with him have I heard him talk about any ethnic group in derogatory terms, or treat whites with whom he interacted with anything but courtesy and respect. He contains within him the contradictions, the good and the bad, of the community that he has served diligently for so many years. I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community.
And Barack Obama later went on in that speech to also talk about his white grandmother who raised him, and in a comment that has gotten a lot of analysis, also saying he could not disown her despite the fact that he heard some rather racist remarks from her in the past. I'd like to start off with you, Paul Beckel. You've been to Barack Obama's church. Was it as he described it?
It was a really memorable experience. About 15 years ago, when I was studying in seminary in Chicago, our class had been reading a book called Black and White Styles in Youth Ministry, and the contrast that was drawn between a case study of a suburban church, a suburban upper-class white church, and Reverend Jeremiah Wright's church, and what they were trying to raise their children to be. And as opposed to trying to be fit in, get along, middle class Americans, Wright was encouraging his children, the children of his congregation, through the work of the congregation, to stand out, to be, as the motto of the church was, unashamedly Christian and unapologetically black. And so when I visited there, now there's an interesting contrast, because in the book that where you say to be so unashamedly black, you might think that this was an exclusive message that they were trying to preach, but that's not how I experienced it at all. When I went to the congregation where there were 2,000-3,000 people, in the service, highly enthusiastic, very moving. As I was welcomed, my wife and I were welcomed with open arms, even though I certainly felt a little bit out of place.
Were there other white people in the church, or was it?
There may have been, but I don't remember. I remember feeling on that level a bit isolated.
What was the service like?
There was music nonstop.
Tell us about the music. Give us a feeling of what it was like in that congregation.
Whether somebody was preaching or whether somebody was reading, whether was somebody was giving announcements, the keyboard musician was there every moment making some sort of musical thematic comment and augmenting what was being the spoken word. And it was incredibly beautiful, and everything flowed together really nicely. But
was there a choir there?
There were two choirs, at least. I'm not remembering all the details, but what stood out were two particular music events. One was there was a children's choir where there were over 100 young kids that were just making beautiful music. But especially there was probably a 7 or 8-year-old boy who at one point was brought onto the stage, given a microphone, and expected to sing a solo. And the kid was scared, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what was going to happen, but that congregation, that huge group of people, nurtured him up on that stage while he hesitated, while he cried, while he tried to build up the courage to sing his solo. And they had such incredible patience calling out to him, you can do it, and not expecting him to leave if he couldn't do it, but giving him the time he needed. I mean, they were just so on the spot nurturing to him until he built up the courage. And that's the kind of that was an embodiment of the youth ministry that they profess to do, that we really believe that our kids can stand out in our people. We in the congregation can stand out and grow up and face difficult situations because we're supporting one another.
Daryl, growing up in New Orleans, growing up in the segregated South when you were younger, you've attended churches like that. Does this ring a bell with you?
Yes, it rings a bell. I'm sitting here and I'm smiling and I'm thinking about the uncomfortability that Paul experienced, which is not unusual for Caucasians when they're in a setting where they are few or they are the minority. In the United States, it's not uncommon for African Americans to always be in the minority, and so we've grown accustomed to it. Within the black church, however, historically, what you were witnessing, Paul, in many instances, whether it's done musically or whether it's done orally, is called the call and response. And it's a very authentic form of worship that African Americans brought with them and developed here in the United States, brought with them from Africa and developed here. So, and it's very unsettling because in many other predominantly Caucasian services, the pastor speaks and the people sit and listen and they try not to move and they give him their undivided attention. In the black church,
oh, don't we wish.
Well, they appear to give their undivided attention while they think about the Packers. But in the black church, it's a give and take. It's a response. It's you are involved in the sermon. The individual that comes forward to openly pray, if it's a young child, is encouraged. And so historically, that's why you have seen when we look at the so-called civil rights movement, and I say so-called because, quite frankly, Martin King and those leaders were admonished and advised to call it a civil rights movement instead of a human rights movement so that the nations of the world in New York at the United Nations would not get involved in the apartheid that was happening here or segregation here in the United States. But when someone is called forward and they're asked to do something almost impromptu, that historical calling forth of being involved in that and encouraging that individual. So it's no surprise that as we look over the civil rights era, you start talking about Reverend Hosea, you start talking about Reverend Abernathy, you start talking about Dr. King, you talk about Reverend Jesse Jack. There's a reason why these individuals have these reverends behind their names, and that is historically because they were the ones that were encouraged, they were the ones that went on to school. It was an area that they were allowed to basically become very, very noted, got their education in, and so they were expected then to lead the community and expected to get the community to realize that the next level of leaders must come from that authentic African call and response and encouragement.
Eric Giordano is joining us now, an associate professor of political science at UW-Marathon County. And Eric, Barack Obama, Trinity's arguably most famous parishioner at this point in time, joined the church when he was an organizer, a community organizer on the south side of Chicago. The black churches in the inner city of America really are a center of power in a lot of ways. And if you want to change conditions, if you want to change conditions of poverty and help people raise themselves out of that, there's really nowhere else to go than the black churches.
That's absolutely true, and no more true than in Chicago itself, where it was the result of preaching and teaching in the black congregations that led to the election of Chicago's first black mayor. And
Harold Washington.
That's right. And so as a result of that energy that emerged in the churches and through the churches as well as in other community settings. But absolutely, the churches are center of power in the black community.
Yeah, I'm going to share just real quickly one of my own experiences. I worked as a reporter for Fox News for 3 years in Chicago, and I was often called into usually to cover crime and other events on the south side of Chicago or the west side. But all political parties, affiliations, all the different interest groups paid homage to these churches. I went to a service on the south side of Chicago, which was a funeral service for Willie Dixon, the great musician and composer who penned many of the blues songs that have gone into the lexicon since then. On that stage on the south side of Chicago was Mayor Richard Daley and Louis Farrakhan, and a number of community leaders all across the spectrum. The churches are indeed the center of power, and it is in those churches where I think people who aspire to raise themselves out of poverty, that's where they look first. We're going to take a break right now, and we're going to play some comments from the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, comments that you probably haven't heard before, but which you may nonetheless find disturbing. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
For more information on regional programming for North Central Wisconsin, here at Wisconsin Public Radio, or to have your community event listed with us, check out our local website at wpr.org/WLBL. I'm going to play a segment now of one of Jeremiah Wright's most controversial sermons. This is the one you've heard over and over and over again on cable TV. It's come to be known as the Goddamn America speech. You've seen the short clips. But here's more of what he said on the subject to put it into context. The sermon actually was on the subject of God and government, and he said it is a mistake to confuse the two, and it's sinful to say God is on the side of your government and to say that God blesses your country when your government is doing something that is immoral, unholy, and unchristian. In this case, he was talking about the war in Iraq. Now, a word of warning, this passage is not a lukewarm homily. It contains strong language condemning America's role in the war and words that are designed to get your attention. It will probably offend some of you who are listening.
I have got to pause here, however, as a pastor, because a lot of people still confuse, 2,000 years later, they still confuse God with their government. Now, see, we can see clearly the confusion in the mind of a few Muslims. And please notice, I did not say all Muslims. I said a few Muslims who see Allah as condoning killing and killing any and all who don't believe what they believe. They call it jihad. We can see clearly the confusion in their minds, but we cannot see clearly what it is that we do. We call it crusade. When we turn right around and say that our God condones the killing of innocent civilians as a necessary means to an end. We say that God understands collateral damage. We say that God knows how to forgive friendly fire. We say that God will bless the shock and awe as we take over unilaterally another country, calling it a coalition because we got three guys from Australia going against the United Nations, going against the majority of Christians, Muslims, and Jews throughout the world, making a preemptive strike in the name of God. We cannot see how what we are doing is the same thing Al-Qaeda is doing under a different color flag, calling on the name of a different God to sanction and approve our murder and our mayhem. And let me tell you something. Jesus said something about that too. Oh, yes, he did. Jesus said, how can you see the speck in your brother's eye and can't see the log in your own eye?
Anybody want to react to that?
I think it's great that Wright had the courage to speak up against the wrongs that he sees our government perpetrating. I hope in time to grow in courage myself to be as outspoken and prophetic.
And I imagine there are some in your congregation who would be made to feel uncomfortable if that happened.
I imagine they would, but that's what a relationship is about, is growing and learning from different perspectives.
What about the specific reference to Jesus Christ and the speck in the eye as compared to the log in the eye?
I think it's an apt comparison, and certainly one of the more profound messages of Jesus that we need to pay attention to our own failings as well as pay attention to those around us.
But let's maybe look at something that's a little far back before we get to the New Testament. Let's go to Genesis and look at what happens when Noah comes out of the flood and plants a vineyard, and his son Ham disrespects him. And later on, we find that Noah curses Ham and says that a slave will he be to his brothers all the days of his life. And when you look at the Europeans who stole Africans away from Africa, that was the passage that they specifically used to say that Africans should be enslaved. However, when we read that passage, what we really find out is that Noah does not curse his son Ham. He curses his grandson Canaan. Who are the Canaanites? They are Caucasians. The Hamites' descendants are through Cush. Who are the Cushites? Well, they are related to the Nubians. And who are the Nubians? They occupied the Upper Nile Valley and created at one time a dynasty in Egypt. The Constitution of the United States, in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, basically says for purposes of representation and taxation, we have the 3/5 compromise clause in it, which basically says that Africans being held in slavery for purposes in the South will not be counted except for as 3/5 of a person. They were never intended to be citizens in the United States. Now, that's historical fact, and it comes from early European interpretation of this passage in Genesis. We can look at what happened with women in the United States, not getting to vote until 1920. They were not able to own property. The Constitution never included that they would be voters, that they would be participants in this republic. Well, why is that? Let's go back to the Garden of Eden. And if you ask most women, a lot of women say that, well, women are cursed. In fact, in that episode, the ground is cursed and the snake is cursed. Man nor woman is cursed. But men come out of it saying that, well, women are cursed. They're the reason for it. They are the lesser in terms of the male-female
gender. Our very word evil comes from the word Eve.
There you go. And so women aren't given any rights in this new republic, in this new experience, in saying that God has not given his power to kings, but men have unalienable rights. Well, suddenly we begin to decide in our Constitution that we're only talking about Caucasian men, only Caucasian men who have and own property.
Eric Giordano, we only have a minute here before our news break. Your analysis of the politics behind this sermon.
That's a big question, Glenn, but I think because of the because Reverend Wright's speech became public, and there was obviously the replaying of some segments of his preaching in a public setting, there was a big outcry in the media, especially in right-wing talk radio and on the news, on television. And I think that he felt that there had to be a response. I think there was a concern about how this would play out for the presidential election. And I think the response was actually appropriate to the concern. It was timely. It was the beginning of what I would call a courageous dialogue that needs to be taken further. But hopefully, from his perspective, it's something that would put to rest some concerns about the political issues.
We've got to take a break. We'll be back with more on Route 51 right after this.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Church on Sunday, sleeping, not trying to duck the wrath of God. Preachers filling us with fright. They all trying to teach us what they think is right. They really got to be some kind of nut. I can't use it. I'm trying to make it real compared to what. Bee and where's that honey? Where's my God and where's my money? Unreal values, a crass distortion. Unwed mothers need abortion. Kind of brings to my old young King Tut. He did it now. Trying to make it real compared to what.
40 years ago tomorrow, the Reverend Martin Luther King was shot and killed in Memphis. King was condemned during his life as unpatriotic, an agitator, and labeled by some as a communist. Today, another controversial African-American minister is under attack, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright of Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago, a church that calls Barack Obama a member. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we are looking at the questions of church and state, religion and race, the media and politics, and poverty in America with our guests, the Reverend Paul Beckel of the First Universalist Unitarian Church of Wausau, Daryl Mayfield of Upper Iowa University, and Eric Giordano, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Marathon County. We have a couple of phone lines available for you if you'd like to call in and join the conversation at 261-6371. That's 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. We heard some of Jeremiah Wright's words in the last segment. Now, those words have been widely attacked, but another African-American minister who condemned his own country during a time of war is now honored with his own holiday. Let's listen to the Reverend Martin Luther King in a sermon entitled Beyond Vietnam. This is a sermon that was given exactly 1 year before he was shot and killed 41 years ago tomorrow.
And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. They move sadly and apathetically as we herd them off the land of their fathers into concentration camps where minimal social needs are rarely met. So far, we may have killed 1 million of them, mostly children. They wander into the towns and see thousands of the children, homeless, without clothes, running in packs on the streets like animals. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. They see the children selling their sisters to our soldiers, soliciting for their mothers. What do they think as we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe? This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
That's the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. 41 years ago this week. I have three questions. Should we rescind the national holiday for Dr. King? Should all politicians who have attended Martin Luther King Day services or praised him now be forced to denounce and reject King or be labeled unfit for public office? And finally, how can we praise King's words and condemn Jeremiah Wright's words when they're essentially saying the same thing?
They were speaking at different times to different audiences, and I think it's important that we listen to Jeremiah Wright's words in the context that he's speaking and the audience that he was speaking to. His words, while they might be considered inflammatory by some, I think they were spoken in a context of love for his community and an attempt to empower his community and to hold his nation to accountability, and I admire that.
We just heard Dr. King compare America and what we were doing to the Vietnamese to what Hitler was doing to the Jews in the concentration camps. We heard him decry burning children with napalm, said America was headed for a spiritual death, and he called America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And what if he was to say that today?
Today, Americans are torturing and not apologizing for it. Every new era needs to be called to account for its obscenity. And instead of picking on a few words of Jeremiah Wright's and calling those sound bites to be obscenity, I think we need to point to the real obscenity, which is the hypocrisy and the focus on the wrong values that we America is doing today.
I think you're right. And I think for sure King would be reviled today, even as he was then. While we have later on made the holiday and hold him up as a martyr for the human rights movement in the United States, he was hated for making those types of speeches. There were those who were
Daryl, he was disinvited to the White House by Lyndon Johnson after he made that speech, and he was condemned by Time magazine, which was a conservative magazine at the time. It was run by Henry Luce still back in the 60s, but also by the Washington Post.
Correct. And he spoke, interestingly enough, that King's assassination comes not in leading a civil rights march, but in leading a march for workers' rights in Memphis. And so if you understand the metamorphosis of what King is going through, you understand now that it's more than just blacks or African Americans in the U.S. It's looking at the world and beginning to see the connection between foreign policy and economic policy that's happening outside the United States. And many individuals don't even to this day see that connection.
Well, that's why it's so important to understand Wright's message of liberation theology was not just about black liberation. It was his understanding that the message of Jesus was embodied in the struggle for freedom by any oppressed peoples, and that any of us can engage in that struggle. I can do so as a white person. I can be an agent for liberation if I have the courage to do so.
And I think you're right. But we can't fully, the issue that we have, we can't fully embrace Martin Luther King because, quite frankly, our history books still say he was a black civil rights leader. We can't fully embrace the Native American chief Tecumseh because we say he was a Indian leader. Nobody calls the current occupant of the White House a white leader.
Eric Giordano, Reverend Martin Luther King again reviled during his life for comments like that. Jeremiah Wright being reviled today. This, now as then, is a tough sell for conservative white audiences. What kind of a needle does Barack Obama have to thread in order to overcome this still attract enough people to get elected, which is his goal, but yet not renounce the man who's meant so much to him as his parishioner?
I don't think he's going to convince an extremely conservative white audience by virtue of his latest speech or even his actions, because it appears that, you know, the whole attempt to pick on Reverend Wright's words and to link Obama to that really is an attempt to, you know, smear the Obama campaign to begin with. There's no real attempt to understand the context, as you gentlemen have spoke about, in terms of who Reverend Wright was speaking to, why he was speaking to this audience, what the real message was, which, if you look at it, is not only liberation theology, it really is Christianity in its most basic form, as I would argue Christ himself preached. And so there really isn't that much distinction. Maybe the method of delivery is something that many white Americans can't always necessarily relate to, because our congregations, I say our congregations, white majority congregations often do not tend to, you know, have the same sort of response. And
we have a problem
preaching,
clapping along to the music.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is changing in some congregations, but I feel that it's a difficult sell to this population. I tend to think that Obama did about as good a job as anybody could have done under these difficult political circumstances, in terms of the middle of a presidential campaign that's tightly divided on the Democratic side, to begin a conversation about the nature of how a black man has to tread in two worlds, even in this day and age.
Let's go to the phones. Ned in Wausau, you're on Route 51. Hello, Ned.
Hi. I have a couple comments. First, I agree with you in that Obama did a very good job in responding to the comments about Reverend Wright's sermons. I think that came out in the press, and I think the press was rather surprised at how well he did in his response. And that's the type of good judgment that I expect him to show. And as far as Christianity is concerned, what we have now is the justification of preemptive first strikes, and I have a hard time finding that in the New Testament anywhere. I have a hard time finding torture in Abu Ghraib anywhere in the New Testament. And as far as what happened 4 years ago, this is what I call through the screener. I was a delegate to the 2004 Democratic Convention, and I saw what happened with Karl Rove and the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. And in those ads, they brought down John Kerry very effectively in a smear campaign. And a lot of
that's Hillary Clinton's argument. She's quoted in the newspapers today. Apparently when Bill Richardson endorsed Obama, she said, Bill, he can't get elected. And the Republicans will make sure he won't get elected.
Well, what I'm saying is I think he will be elected because he's already shown the good judgment in being able to respond to attacks of this nature. And secondly, I think that what you've presented today on this program shows the other side that really hasn't been presented yet. So what Obama's going to have to do in his ads is not let this go by like John Kerry did. He's got to reply quickly with his own set of ads, and he's got to have enough money, which I think he does right now, to be able to do effective advertising, to immediately respond, and to give more of the context like you did today. And, you know, when I first heard those comments, I was really appalled a week or two ago. But now, in the context of the larger sermon, it actually makes a lot more sense.
Let's try to, and Ned, thank you so much for your phone call. Let's try to give this a little more context again. We're going to play another segment from the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. And in this segment, he's talking about God and government. Don't confuse the two. But he's saying whereas governments can be evil and ungodly, they can also change.
Prior to Harry Truman's government, the military in this country was segregated. But governments changed prior to the civil rights and equal accommodations laws of the government in this country. There was back segregation by the country, legal discrimination by the government, prohibited blacks from voting by the government. You had to eat in separate places by the government. You had to sit in different places from white folk because the government says so. And you had to be buried in a separate cemetery. It was apartheid American style from the cradle to the grave, all because the government backed it up. But guess what? Governments changed. Under Bill Clinton, we got a messed up welfare to work bill. But under Clinton, blacks had an intelligent friend in the Oval Office. Oh, but governments changed. The election was stolen. We went from an intelligent friend to a dumb Dixiecrat, a rich Republican who has never held a job in his life, is against affirmative action, against education, I guess he is, against health care, against benefits for his own military, and gives tax breaks to the wealthiest contributors to his campaign. Governments change sometimes for the good and sometimes for the bad.
Governments change. Eric Giordano, I'm going to throw this one in your lap.
Governments do change. And earlier I was talking about, you know, you asked me about white conservatives in particular, white male conservatives, and, you know, what their take is. I mean, I think we have to at least acknowledge that rhetoric like that can be disturbing to people and probably is painting other people with a broad brush that isn't fair. I can see why people would be very uncomfortable with that. We talked earlier about some of the truths in the sermon of Reverend Wright, but I think it's important to point out that, you know, when we're lumping an entire group, an entire, you know, whatever color, whatever race, whatever political party, creed, I think people can respond negatively to that. So, I mean, I think this is always going to be an issue for Republicans, for conservatives, when they hear rhetoric like that. I think the mistake is where they're trying to link Reverend Wright somehow to Barack Obama. I think that's a mistake. I think the two are separate.
I agree with you that it's a mistake to link Barack Obama to Jeremiah Wright. I'm not sure, however, that when Reverend Wright says Dixiecrats, He is speaking specifically of the 1948 election, the group led by Strom Thurmond, which when they lost, they joined the Republican Party. And it is from that point that the plank in the Republican Party starts to be either anti-poverty, anti-whoever obviously does not have money. As he said, governments change. Prior to that, when the Civil War ends, things are in place and African Americans are being representatives. They're being elected. They're going to Washington. Rutherford B. Hayes comes in as president, makes a deal with the Southerners to pull out Southern troops, and Jim Crow becomes the law of the land. Let's go further back. 1802, the Congress of the United States passes a statute that says requiring that only white people can be employed to carry the U.S. mail. Now, why does this happen? It happens because the Postmaster General Gideon Granger was opposed to black letter carriers because he was afraid, quote, that by traveling from day to day, they will learn that a man's rights do not depend on his color. It's not until 1867 that John W. Curry of Washington, D.C. becomes the first African American to carry the mail in the United States. What we have here in Reverend Wright is basically setting a historical context that governments do change. And when he uses that term Dixiecrats, individuals need to understand he is speaking specifically of the 1948 presidential campaign, what Strom Thurmond did, and how those Republicans, or Dixiecrats, I should say, then left the Democratic Party and began to form another plank within the Republican
Party. Sure, I think you're absolutely right. But going forward, I think one of the things that's difficult about those who are listening to that sermon, perhaps out of context, I would argue, is that, you know, there is definitely a link between the Dixiecrats and the current administration and the current party. And I'm not saying some of those links aren't warranted. I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes of how someone mm-hmm. who, you know, hears this and immediately assumes that his party, his race, his heritage, maybe not in their mind, a Dixiecrat heritage, maybe just the party of Lincoln heritage, we can debate that, is going to respond to that. That was my point, that some people are going to respond negatively when they hear those types of words.
I can understand that, too, but the key word that I think you just uttered was immediately. If someone reacts immediately and shuts off the conversation, doesn't want to really understand, then yes, the conversation will go nowhere. But if we do have the courage to really listen to one another and hear even things that make us uncomfortable, hear one another's pain, hear one another's outrageous and inflammatory remarks, because we have some confidence that we can get through that together. And
well, it seems to me that that's the thing that Obama in that speech has actually called us to. The next level.
I want to play something from that speech right now, Daryl. And what I think you have to understand, too, about Jeremiah Wright is he is preaching on the south side of Chicago in the midst of one of the great slums in America, and one of the great tragedies in America is the condition of poverty that exists in our inner cities. I mentioned before that I worked for Fox News for a while covering stories, and I've seen people eating out of dumpsters. I've seen people sleeping in cardboard boxes on Lower Wacker Drive when it's 10 below zero out. I've been in the Robert Taylor homes. I've been in Cabrini Green. I've walked through hallways that smell of urine. I've seen gang graffiti. I've had to cover stories where kids have been shot and killed simply because they went to school. I've been to some of those schools. I've seen the glass littering the pavement in front of them, people passing back and forth between a metal detector just in order to get inside, cops standing by while people were selling drugs, and prostitutes were plying their trade right outside on the school grounds. This is Reverend Wright's world. It's a world that exists in America. And, you know, he's not up there trying to recruit for the U.S. Marine Corps.
Right.
Let's play this comment from Barack Obama, and let's see the extent to which you think he's certainly trying to bridge the divide. Let's see if he's successful.
And the lack of basic services in so many urban black neighborhoods. Parks for kids to play in. Police walking the beat. Regular garbage pickup. Building code enforcement. All helped create a cycle of violence, blight, and neglect that continues to haunt us. This is the reality in which Reverend Wright and other African Americans of his generation grew up. They came of age in the late 50s and early 60s, a time when segregation was still the law of the land and opportunity was systematically constricted. For the men and women of Reverend Wright's generation, the memories of humiliation and doubt and fear have not gone away, nor is the anger and the bitterness of those years. That anger may not get expressed in public, in front of white coworkers or white friends, but it does find voice in the barbershop or the beauty shop or around the kitchen table, and occasionally it finds voice in the church on Sunday morning, in the pulpit, and in the pews. The fact that so many people are surprised to hear that anger in some of Reverend Wright's sermons simply reminds us of the old truism that the most segregated hour of American life occurs on Sunday morning.
And he goes on to say that whites, too, have legitimate grievances, that many of them do not consider themselves to be particularly privileged, and they have legitimate concerns about affirmative action and busing because it negatively affects their lives, which are not exactly an easy lot. Very quickly, I've got 10 seconds for each of you to wrap things up because this hour has gone by too quickly.
Well, Glenn, I think part of the description of that community was correct when you were talking about a community of poverty. But Obama mentioned, too, that there were both the welfare mothers and the doctors and lawyers. And Wright's magic was that he could bring together by allowing people to speak their own truths. He was able to create a much broader, more diverse community.
Daryl?
Perhaps our history has already been future. We've already seen. We are simply not willing to accept it. I'm speaking of the country of South Africa. When Nelson Mandela becomes the president there, one of the things that they do is that they have these meetings that they can talk about apartheid, about those who participated, those who were the victims. And we've never had that type
maybe
of discussion in the U.S.
Maybe this is a chance for us to open up.
Thanks,
an opportunity for discussion. Thank you, Eric Giordano. Thank you, Paul Beckel. Thank you, Daryl Mayfield. And thanks to all of you who listened to you today. Route 51 is heard every Thursday at 5 on our Ideas Network stations, WLBL 91.9 FM Wausau, 930 AM Auburndale, Stevens Point, WHBM 90.3 FM Park Falls. Thanks to today's on-air producer, Kelson Quisler, our executive producer, Rick Ryer. Compared to what was performed by Les McCann and Eddie Harris, and Jesus Drop the Charges is off the DVD Say Amen, Somebody. Thanks for riding with us today. Until next week, we're heading out of town. Special love.